LA Talk Radio thanks you for being a listener. Did you know you too can host your own radio show with us? Go to our site at latalkradio.com or email info@latalkradio.com right now and start your show today.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Oh my, I have a couple of things to share, unless you're dying to watch it.
No, go for it.
No crisis in the family, nothing going on for
always
you?
Always a crisis, not at this moment.
But the moderate level, not the severe level.
Exactly.
Oh, so I got totally hooked into travel porn again.
No.
Yes. So you know how I have my Santa Fe place.
Yes.
And the goal is to definitely be there in 3 years.
Okay.
But hold it as a part-time thing, not just fully move, but keep both houses for a while. But then I started hearing these great things about Kansas.
This is insane. From who?
One of my clients.
Dorothy? I mean,
Dorothy came back.
Yeah,
exactly. She came to visit me in a dream. Anyway, and I'm like, okay, tornadoes, yada, yada. But I'm going online looking at all these. There's like area called Overland Park, Kansas. There's this website called livability or areavibes.com or .org, and they compare different places to live. So this area of Kansas is ranked number 7 in the country of best places to live based on weather and this and this. So I went on and I looked at some of these houses, and I'm like, oh my God, these houses are to die for.
Uh-huh.
It's so inexpensive. So I contacted a realtor, and I'm like, okay, but give me the rub on tornadoes. Like, really, tornadoes. And he says, you know what? We just had one the other day. You'd like blink, and they're here, and they're there. They're not that bad, and they don't really go into the big cities as much. Uh-huh. Sure, you can get decimated, but no more than you can from an earthquake.
I was
here.
Thinking that. Yeah.
So anyway, so that
was
my excitement.
So you're really going to look into this?
I'm looking into it. And then I think, oh, how many properties do I want to have?
I
do not want to be one of those people, a real estate tycoon who then crashes. You know. But that was my excitement.
That's
plus,
so cool.
I got on fire writing a new book proposal. So
that's so exciting.
Topic to be revealed at another time. How about you? What's up?
So first of all, you have to excuse me. I have Twizzler nubs in my teeth. Have you ever had those little, they're like little Twizzlers.
Oh, I get you now. You are having to give up chocolate.
Yes, so now
I
substituted.
You're sucking up Twizzlers.
Yes, exactly. So, everything's okay. You know, it's really funny. I'm going to take my kids to the dentist today. I swear to God, my kids are the only kids on the planet who love the doctor. Like, this
really?
Was my bribe this morning. London, if you don't get on the shoes, we're not going to the dentist today. He got his shoes. I swear to God. And then yesterday we had a doctor's appointment. They're like, yay! It's like bizarre.
Is it the attention?
Yes.
Do they get
yes, they don't get enough from me.
They need
150%. So it's somebody else giving them attention. Yeah.
That's pretty good though.
Isn't that funny?
You have to have a bonus with your kids somewhere here and there,
yes.
Right? I mean, because
they
are trouble with a capital T in so many other ways.
Yes.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's
good.
Awesome. Oh, I also went and saw Peter Pan this weekend at the Civic Arts Plaza. Oh my God, it was so cute.
Oh, good.
So cute.
You know what's so funny? I was watching a show. Oh my God, you should watch this. It's called Gypsy. It's about a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my God, it's so insane. It's crazy. I'm curious from your perspective to what you think, but it's on is it on Netflix? I'm trying to think where I saw it, but it reminded me that because her daughter in one of the scenes is Peter Pan, but I was like, where did I just see Peter Pan? But you have to see the series. It's
well,
really
and
good.
You know how I love fairies, right?
Yes.
So Tinkerbell is a fairy, but her light dims out, right?
Uh-huh.
And she's about to die. So they had the whole audience. They had to clap if they believe in fairies. Of course, I told Tiffany, who knows I love fairies, that I clap the loudest. She goes, Mom, you're just such a weirdo.
It's true, right? All right, let's talk about last week.
Oh my God, she was fabulous. Dr. Sherry Ross, the author of She-ology, and boy, did we get to talk about vaginas.
We really did. We were all up in there. We really were. She was spectacular. One of the best, most compassionate doctors I've ever talked with. I mean, she really was. It was like, you know, there was no like arrogance. She was just, you know, it was like a friend. She was lovely.
She was awesome. So if you missed that show, please go tune in and tell us what you think. And anytime you want to give us a call, you can at 323-203-0815. Make sure to like us on Facebook. And we are going to introduce our new guest. Kelly, you have the honor, since this is somebody that you know from middle school.
Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. So I'm trying to think if I should give the background first or like the official bio. What's your preference?
Let's do official bio and then just dive into the personal.
Okay. All right. She's going to hate me for that. Andrea Avery is the author of Sonata, a memoir of pain and the piano. Her writing has appeared in Plowshares, Real Simple, which I read, by the way. I was just telling you, Deborah, it was one of the best articles I've ever read. And I'm not kidding, just because she's my friend. But we'll get into that. The Oxford American and the Politics of Women's Bodies. She was the winner of Real Simple's second annual Life Lessons Essay Contest. That's the one I read. And a finalist in Glamour's Essay Contest. She holds a BA, MFA, and doctorate from Arizona State University and teaches English in Phoenix. She's an active volunteer with the Arthritis Foundation. This is her first book. She is at work on a novel.
Welcome, so, Andrea.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I have to give the personal background, okay? So,
yeah, that one's more fun, I think.
So Andrea and I were both in Greece, and we were both cast as Frenchie. And I did it the first night, and it was like, yeah, I like walked out. I'm like, damn, I'm pretty good, you know. And then the next night, she blew it out of the park. She did like an accent, and she was like I was like, oh my god, no, like really.
Well, just
I
be
like,
grateful you went first, right?
Yes, that's true. That, or maybe Andrea did go first, and that's why I felt so bad. But in any event, seriously, one of the most talented people I know, Andrea. So I'm so happy.
Well, you're very sweet. I think your memory has maybe burnished that my performance into a. into a finer kind of shine than it had, but God bless you. Thank you.
The funniest part was the picture that you put up there that you look, you really did look like Shelley Long. I mean, it was really funny.
That was creepy.
It really
weird.
Was. So
really?
She had posted some pictures from the performance, and it was like Shelley Long's twin. Like, it was so scary because she's blonde and like, you know, thin and long and lanky, and it was just like the puff hair. It was perfect. So, all right, enough embarrassment. Let's talk
good
about
times.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you guys stayed connected, like, through Facebook the whole time? Or
yeah, we've been on Facebook. I mean, I'm dying more about, like, what else you've been doing, so we can talk about that, too. But, no, I mean, it's hard, you know. But
yeah, I haven't actually seen you in, you know, 25 years.
That's
but,
crazy.
You know.
But I did, seriously, I was, like, taking a dump, and I'm looking at my Real Simple magazine, and I came across your article that blew me out of the water. I'm not kidding. Like, no, I mean, you didn't, I was telling Deborah, like, you didn't tell me about it. It wasn't like somebody had told me about it. I literally got the magazine, which I love, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is really good. And then I look at the author, I'm like, no. And I think I actually, like, reached out to you and was like, is this you? Like, I was so impressed. So I just have to say
that's
that
out loud. That's so funny.
Isn't that funny?
Well, let's just dive right in. I'm so eager to find out your story because this is just fascinating. The subtitle of the book is A Memoir of Pain and the Piano. So please do tell.
Well, I was an aspiring pianist. And I know that sounds maybe foolish to say because, you know, I was a kid. But I was a kid who took piano lessons, and I fell just hard and fast in love with the piano. And showed some pretty striking promise and thought, well, this is I'm ready to sign my life away. This is what I'm going to be. This is what I'm going to do. And kind of just took off at the piano. And then a sort of complicating factor was when I was 12, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, which I had never heard of, had no idea that that was a thing that people could get. As a child, for sure. And not only, I mean, I got it at 12, which at the time people would say, oh, honey, you're too young to have arthritis. I'm like, well, tell my joints, because they do not seem to have gotten the memo. But there are kids who get it in infancy. So it's not, I mean, I was a preteen, but you can get it in early childhood. So that was news to me. But obviously the symptoms of arthritis and the complications of arthritis present some pretty serious obstacles to a life at the piano. I had what I refer to in the book as a sort of a head start, because I had 5 years at the piano before I got arthritis, and that was enough for me to, like I said, fall in love with it. And then my teenage and adolescent years were this process of kind of trying to outrun arthritis, trying to eke out as much accomplishment and music at the piano as I could before the kind of inevitable decay of arthritis made that impossible. And the sort of soul searching or the identity building, which is, all right, the thing that I like best about myself, the thing that I think I have to contribute, the thing that is notable about me, is not going to be possible. So how do I be become something else and like it? How do I be a person I like and not this sort of sour husk of a person who walks around kind of limping around going, I was supposed to be a pianist, you know? I wanted to be happy being something else if that wasn't going to be possible.
Yeah, wow.
That's the book.
A story of triumph.
What was so interesting to me, the book is fabulous. You are such a great writer. And what I loved, the part that stuck out to me a lot was like how meticulous your mom was with all the notes. So her mom was a former nurse, is that right? Or a nurse?
She was a nurse. She was a working nurse.
Okay.
My whole childhood.
And so she would write down Andrea's symptoms like from the beginning. So every appointment she'd be like, okay, you know, this is what happened yesterday, this is what happened today. And so it really helped kind of look at the progression.
So it's amazing.
And she diagnosed me. I mean, she's a note keeper by temperament. I mean, I'm just born of this family of kind of fastidious note keepers. Everybody in my family loves data. We love different data, but everybody loves information. And so she kept these notebooks for all my siblings, height, weight, symptoms, illnesses, medications. It's just that my notebook is six times the size of any of my siblings because I had this crazy illness.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, when I had these symptoms that were starting to happen and they were mysterious and the pediatrician said, oh, I think it's growing pains, my mom, I won the mom lottery, said, I just don't think that's what this is. And she, in her training, had once met a kid with rheumatoid arthritis.
Wow.
And she thought, I think that's what we're looking at here. And so she made an appointment at the pediatric rheumatology clinic at Children's Hospital. And when they told her it was going to be months before I could get in, it's not going to work, we need to get in sooner. I mean, she saved my bacon that time and a million times since. And those notes, I mean, when I was like, okay, Mom, I think I'm going to write this book. I'm going to write, and I need to balance out my memories of things. I need to fact check myself. She photocopied all those hundreds of pages. I mean, and sent me, I live on the other side of the country from my mother, and she sent me these packages in the mail. I would get this fat envelope every couple of weeks of more pages she photocopied for me.
Wow.
And then I kind of reassembled them into a three-ring binder, and then I had my version of her notebook in my house. And so it was a great gift for a writer to have information.
I love that she still kept it. Wow.
Yeah.
No, this is great.
Yeah.
Like in the book here, you say, one pain in multiple sites, right shoulder, upper arm, left wrist, neck, hip, foot, toes, temperature 99.2, 7:30 crying, however 99 at 1 p.m. I mean, it goes on and on. Like, it's amazing.
I mean, she's incredible.
Unbelievable.
And they're really touching because some of them, like the one you just read, are kind of clinical. That's, you can see my mom as nurse in them. And then there are these parts that just devastate me now that I'm not a mother, but I'm a woman of mothering age. I'm a teacher. I relate to the mom character now in a way I didn't when I was a kid. Like when I watched 80s movies, now I feel bad for the parents, you know.
Right.
Watching National Lampoon's Vacation, and I think Clark Griswold is really just trying to give his family a good time, you know. Anyway, so I read these notes that my mom made, and there are these clinical kind of nurse shorthand, and then in the margins it'll say, Andrea danced the Charleston at a bat mitzvah today, or Andrea did a handstand today with an exclamation point. And it's like the mother peeks through, and you realize that she's managing this in the way she knows how. My mom is a great project manager. Get a binder, take notes, organize it, get it done. But she's also a mother, and that I could do a handstand or that I could dance just made her so happy that she wrote that down in her notebooks too. And so the notebooks are this fascinating depiction of mother as mother and mother as nurse, and the kind of intersection where those two kind of identities meet in the management of this chronically ill kid.
So just curiously, so you and Kelly knew each other when you were in middle school. So this is like just after your diagnosis that you met. Kelly, were you aware?
No, I was just going to say, I had no idea. I mean, and I'm sure a lot of people didn't. Did you talk about it, Andrea, or did they like know about it? But I had no idea.
You know, my closest friends knew about it enough that like, you know, one of them told my boyfriend that it was contagious and that if he French kissed me, he'd get it.
No.
So clearly she knew. But what's been interesting now that the book is out is a lot of people have told me, like, I didn't know that about you. And I thought it was the most glaring, notable thing about me, you know, at the time. I thought it was this sort of, I was walking around in this cloud of illness. But I realize now that other people, that's not what they were noting about me, and that this has all been sort of something of a surprise to them to know that I was kind of privately in so much pain or so sick. And it reminds me that everybody's like that. Like, especially in middle school. Everybody's walking around thinking they're wearing a big sign that says, like, inadequate freak, you know? Yes. And everyone else is like, oh, I thought you were adorable and fun, you know?
Right. Completely. It's exact, because I felt so crappy in middle school. Like, it's the worst feeling ever. You feel like, ugh, you're unlovable and just unattractive. And so,
and you were like this darling, magnanimous, friendly, warm, effusive, talented, charismatic
so sweet.
Person, right? So, you were wrong about yourself.
So sweet. That's so funny. So I have to ask both of you, because you know you can tell me from each other's perspective.
Sure.
Were you both so funny way back then?
You know what's funny? I don't think I was that funny then. I think I was like, I was more sweet. I've gotten more bitchy over the years. So I probably was a little more kind then. I think my humor came out later. But Andrea, you were always funny. Like, you were always like performance.
I think I've gone the opposite way. I think I was a bitch on wheels in middle school. I thought like the funniest thing you could do was be like sarcastic.
Uh-huh.
And as I've aged, I've like softened. You know, uh-huh. I like don't, you know.
That's
I,
funny.
You know, I think so. Maybe we've met in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. That's so funny.
That is so funny. Can you give our listeners a little bit more detailed description about what rheumatoid arthritis actually is? How that would show up? What would they feel?
Yes, I would love to, because it is a disease in need of better PR for sure, and I'm gunning to be the face of rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe I'll get discovered. It is okay. So because it's called arthritis, people know a little bit about it. They think, oh, your hands hurt and stuff, mm-hmm. right? And so that's true if it affects your hands, which does mine. But it's an arthritis that's only in some way similar to, like, old people arthritis. The arthritis that most people know about is osteoarthritis, which is the grandma, grandpa golfing, gardening hands, or the, like, you know, football player who had enough injuries that now he has a bum knee every time it rains, et cetera. That's a kind of mechanical wear and tear arthritis that we're all going to get if we haul our bodies around long enough, right? Our bodies are machines that wear out.
Sure.
Rheumatoid arthritis is a cousin to that arthritis, but it's an autoimmune disease, which means that it's not a mechanical issue so much. It's an autoimmune disease. So your immune system has gotten this bad information, and it has decided to go bonkers. And the site of its attack happens to be your joint. So that's mm-hmm. where you get the manifestation of the arthritis that makes people think it's, oh, just a joint problem. But it's really not. It's a systemic issue that can affect your heart and your eyes and your skin. And it is profoundly, or can be profoundly, crippling. It can have complications that are fatal. I don't want to get too dark, but It's not this kind of pesky, oh, pop a few Advil and get back in the saddle kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And like we talked about at the beginning of our chat, it can affect people really early in life. The kind of prime years that people might get rheumatoid arthritis is, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. That's mm-hmm. a pretty classic first diagnosis. But there is a juvenile form of it that mm-hmm. affected me when I was 12 and can affect people. I know a doctor. She's a doctor, so that's amazing. She's actually a rheumatologist, but she's had rheumatoid arthritis since she was like 18 months old.
Wow.
So it's really an arthritis writ large as a category of diseases is the number one cause of disability in the United States.
Wow.
And rheumatoid arthritis, yeah, and rheumatoid arthritis as a subset of that is a really, really serious, complicated medical issue that I'm happy to go around telling people about, because
sure.
it is widely misunderstood.
Exactly. My grandma had rheumatoid arthritis, and mm-hmm. and my father-in-law is a rheumatologist. So,
oh wow,
yeah, kind of funny. But still, knowing that, you've explained it really well, because I too, like, I forget it's an autoimmune disease. I mean, I think
yeah
you just think, oh, your joints and okay, you know, inflammation and things like that. But
so yeah,
I guess my question to
yeah,
you
yeah, the
is,
joints are kind of the symptoms, and the other stuff, the underlying stuff, is really the disease process.
Sure. Yeah. So is it the type of thing that you are medicated for life, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, yes. There can be a remission that happens with some people with rheumatoid arthritis. Usually, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to speak for other people's experience, but I'm pretty sure that if they experience remission, they're probably still going to take medication. I don't know. I've never had I shouldn't talk, because I've never had remission, and I don't really expect to.
Mm-hmm.
You hear these ads that say moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis?
Yes.
I think I have the severe version.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never had any remissive periods.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality, and one of the other benefits of having my mother, is that she's never like a sugarcoater, kind of she never wanted to delude me.
Yeah.
I've always known that I'm going to be managing this illness actively with medications and therapies my whole life. This is the kind of thing that I'm going to be treating forever. I don't mean to sound bleak or, you know, but the likelihood of a remissive period now after almost 30 years of constant disease activity is pretty slim. So sure. Now what medication I take is always changing because as they discover newer things about the disease process and as they come up with more kind of innovative medications, the sort of thinking and how you treat it has changed. So I've lived through a couple of eras of that. When I was first diagnosed, it was very much you treated it with, it was sort of the tail end of treating it with steroids.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of falling out of favor, and drugs like methotrexate, which is often given as a chemotherapy drug, was kind of a gold standard. And then around the time I went to college, there was this sort of advent of disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, these biologic drugs that operate slightly differently on the immune system. And so I've been through several of those, but, you know, they work and then they stop working. It's always a matter of matching the right one to your physiology.
So I'm hearing that it's treatable but not curable. Is there any advances in science thus far? Are they making any big steps toward a cure?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything about a cure. Certainly, the Arthritis Foundation, with which I'm very active, that's where they are devoting their energies and their efforts and their fundraising, not just to awareness and advocacy and programs and things that help people live with it, but to really press for kind of a cure. Because, like I said, it fits into the category of number one disabling diseases in the United States, arthritis as a family of diseases. And if you think about the ages that I told you, it strikes people at 20s, 30s, 40s. I mean, that's the prime of career building, sure. Family building. It's this huge cost to our economy if people are disabled and unable to work because of arthritis. So I can't say, though, that I've heard any buzz about, you know, it being the hottest scientific topic in terms of seeking a cure.
Right.
In my more skeptical and cynical moments, I wonder if, you know, it's not the sexiest disease, trust me. And it doesn't have, you know, it's not a life or death thing in the sense that, like, if you get it, you'll die, you know.
Sure.
It diminishes quality of life, and it does have complications that can shorten your lifespan. But I don't know if it has the appeal as a research topic of, I'm going to be the person who cures rheumatoid arthritis. First step,
right.
Explaining to everyone I know what it is, you know.
Right.
Also, you know, as a kind of mouthy feminist, rheumatoid arthritis, like all autoimmune diseases, affects women at higher rates than it does men.
Oh, really?
It's more prevalent in women than men. And I happen to think that if it were reversed and it were a predominantly male at the prime of their life disease, people would be like, stop the presses. We've got to cure this.
That's interesting.
I think it's easier to sort of ignore it as a women's health issue.
Uh-huh.
That's the cynical, mouthy feminist in me that thinks that
it's
being in large part a women's health issue makes it more ignorable.
Well, historically, that's been true. So there's,
yep.
I'm sure, some element of truth to that now.
Sure.
If you just tuned in, we are speaking with the lovely, funny, adorable, beautiful Andrea Avery. Mouthy feminist, who is the author of Sonata, a memoir of pain, and the piano is speaking to us and educating us very nicely. Rheumatoid arthritis. Are you in pain every day?
People ask me that all the time. I suppose I am. If I stop and take inventory and I think, okay, what hurts right now?
Mm.
My left fingers hurt. My right hip hurts. Pain is like noise or other kind of constant stimulus. You can learn to tune it out. You can learn to adopt a different sort of threshold as your baseline. And so if I'm honest with myself, yes, on any given day, everything, lots of things hurt. But that's a workable normal. I was working on my novel this morning. I'm doing the things I need to do today. So I'm allowing myself to kind of compact that level of pain down and call it the floor. And unless something really extraordinary happens, like a tendon ruptures or a joint, you know, gets super inflamed, then I don't really take note of it as pain. Because if I did, it would be like when I was growing up, There was a family across the street whose car alarm went off like three nights a week, and they never seemed to respond to it. And and it got to the point where like the car alarm would go off and the whole neighborhood would just ignore it. It's like that.
Yeah.
Because if you respond to the car alarm every time, you're always going to be running out in the street and being like, Andy Hotchkiss, is everything okay? Is somebody trying to steal your Porsche?
So kind of a desensitization.
I don't react.
Yeah.
Kind of desensitized.
So yeah. And that's it's like maybe a coping thing, but it I can't react to every taking that too far where I think, oh, weird, my hand doesn't work. I'll wait it out. It'll come back. And then I learn, oh, wait a minute. Actually, I should have done something about that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I'm still learning, even 30 years in, which kind of car alarms to pay attention to and which ones not to.
I love that analogy, by the way. I love that. So in essence, did you write the book as sort of this PR message, or it was more cathartic for you?
Kind of all, both. Initially, you know, I got an MFA in fiction writing, and I was writing this terrible novel. It was terrible. And I was talking to a teacher. I brought it to him. It was like I brought him like a dead cat carcass. I brought him these pages, and I was like, what is this smelly thing? Why do you want this? And he was like, no. Do you like it? And I said, no. He said, well, if you don't like it, why do you think anyone else will? And I thought, oh, I don't know. You know, and I said, well, what am I supposed to write? And he said, you need to write the book that you want to read. And it was like the clouds parted. The best teachers can say really simple things to you, and you're like, you hear angels and harps and things, and you're like, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. And I thought, all right, what's the book I want to read? And the book I wanted to read, the book I'd been looking for decades at that point, was a book that accomplished one thing that you mentioned, which is kind of setting the record straight or educating people about rheumatoid arthritis so that I could stop having to explain to everybody at the grocery store, like, no, it's not because I cracked my knuckles. No, you know.
Yeah.
So I wanted to accomplish that. That's a book I wanted to read. But I also wanted a book that was literary and smart, that wasn't like a self-help book. There's an awful lot of self-help books about arthritis. And they're like, their advice is usually like, eat fruits and vegetables and drink water. And like, yep, that's what everybody should do, you know. And I didn't want to write a spiritual book exactly. And I wanted to write a book that was funny in parts, but that was really honest about not just the realities of rheumatoid arthritis as a joint disease, but the realities of your questions around identity and self-worth and self-love and future building for a person who's sick and young.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find that book. I wanted to find a book that would level with me. An author who would speak to me through her book that said, like, so you're worried that no one will ever want to have sex with you. Totally reasonable worry. Let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. I had never found that book. So I thought, I'll write that book. I want to write a book that, you know, a 17-year-old who's chronically ill, who's in her bedroom thinking, you know, how am I going to maneuver my way through dorm room makeout sessions with this body that's like, smells like Bengay? I want to level with that person. And I want to write that book. So I wanted to accomplish all those things. I wanted to be sort of educational and informative about rheumatoid arthritis. I wanted it to be, open-hearted and sincere and kind of pull off the veil and say, like, yeah, there's some really dark and scary moments here. And in the process, I discovered that it was good for me. I didn't set out to write it as therapy for me, but to make something beautiful and well-composed and artistic out of kind of the shambles of my musical ambitions, mm-hmm. was really restorative for me.
Oh, I bet. Wow, that's beautiful. So now I'm curious, what was it like to have sex?
I should get right down to it.
Well,
since we talked vaginas all last week.
I don't know how much of this is a function of arthritis or just myself. I was a kid who was terrified of sex. I was thinking, it was like doomsday. I thought, like, oh, I'm still off the hook now if I'm 14, but oh God, by the time I'm 18, it's probably going to be time to have sex. I was afraid of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me like painful and scary. And then I got this arthritis and thought, you know, my body is problematic. I don't want to be in my body. Why do I want to invite someone else to be in my body? It was like I had a crappy apartment and, you know, be like, I'll meet you outside. Pick me up. Let's go to your place. I didn't want to hang out in my body. And so again, some of that is just who I was even before and despite arthritis. And some of it got sort of heightened and complicated by that. There's some pretty kind of awkward moments. Like I said, you know, I'd go home from a bar with a boy in college or whatever. And I'd be like, oh, you sleep on the floor. That's going to be like, like, I can get down. I can get down, but right. like, how am I going to get up? And what if I don't have any pants on? Like, it's going to be awkward. So, so what I did to cope with that was I fashioned myself into like every guy's best girlfriend, right? I was like the one of the guy's friend to sort of avoid to avoid the situation entirely.
Wow, so interesting. Oh my gosh.
But we should hope you grew out of that.
I did, and everybody who reads the book is like, thinks that my husband, my now husband, Fred, is sort of the knight in shining armor, because it was, you know, you have to read the book. I don't want to spoil it, but it was when I found a person who was like, look, I don't care what this body is like. That's not what I'm in this for. Then everything, then all my sort of problems were solved, and all the things I'd spent, you know, all of adolescence worrying about were not really worries after all.
That's beautiful.
So sweet.
Yeah. Who else, and you mentioned your mom and now your husband, who else in your world of growing up was so instrumental in helping you get through this process, you know, support?
Well, my family, I have a great family.
Sounds like it.
You know, I like I said, I won the mom lottery. I shudder to think what I would have done if I ended up with this illness without that exact mother. But I also have this really interesting father, and his kind of, the book sort of depicts my sort of getting to know him and our kind of reaching an understanding. He's a CIA physicist.
Wow.
He's a character. And then I have these three siblings. I have these three older siblings who are funny, smart, charismatic, dynamic, accomplished, amazing people. And they're all older than me. And so I was like born into this family of like, it was already populated with all these cool people that I wanted to like me and I wanted to approve of me and I wanted to include me. And so they're important characters in my book. One of the things I write about is how the experience of chronic illness and disability can sort of take you away. It can sort of estrange you from people. You live a world they don't live. And so in some ways I felt different from my family and alone even when I was with them sometimes because of the experiences I was going through that I couldn't share with any of them.
Sure.
But one of the arcs I tried to sort of shape as the book progresses is that I've realized that even though I've felt alone at times, I've never been alone. I was born into this nest full of wonderful people who love me and who don't see my illness or my disability as the most interesting thing about me and gave me this really safe, vibrant, creative home base where I could figure out exactly how to be me and then take that kind of out into the world and always know I can return there and be welcomed and loved. So my family is crucial to me.
You have such a beautiful attitude about it, and it sounds like you came in from the start. I mean, do you feel like this is people are born with this type of attitude, or do you think it's like you have to like push for it, and it's like, okay, you know, I'm really going to push myself.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of things, there's an innate kind of, you have children, you know, they're just born wired a certain way. They come out with certain.
Mine are crazy.
Like things. Right. Yeah. No, they're adorable.
They are adorable.
I think so. I mean, I credit people, you know, when people ask like, where do you get this good attitude? I think so much of it is my parent, how I was parented, that I have this family that's like very, oh, that's not going to work. Let's find a different way to do it. Kind of thing. Very creative, very, you know, a couple summers ago, I had this really bad shoulder injury. I had a shoulder replacement. And in the course of the surgery, I got a really bad nerve injury and I lost all use of my right arm and hand for months. No sensation. It was like, I kept calling it dead man's arm, which did not charm my parents the way I thought it would. So anyway, my parents came and stayed with me for like a month. Mm. And, you know, I was little things were making me crazy. Like, I can't put my own deodorant on because I can't hold the deodorant bottle. Mm. So my dad and I went to Home Depot and we're like trolling the aisles. And he's like, I'll know it when I see it. He wanted to like rig something up, like a deodorant applier mechanism for me so I could do it for myself. But that kind of gleeful, let's figure out a way to do this. Let's figure out a way to solve this.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, I couldn't twist this turban towel thing with just one hand. So she got a piece of Velcro out and she sewed it. And so I have these parents who in the micro instances are like, all right, so that's not the way you're going to be able to do that. Let's find a different way to do it. But that's been true. That's what they've modeled for me in the macro. All right, so you're not going to be able to be a pianist. Let's figure out how you can be something else. You know? So I think so much of it is the kind of culture, the home culture I was raised in and how I was parented, that kind of figure out a different way to get it done.
Sure.
Spirit was rewarded at my in my home, and so, you know,
it's beautiful.
And it sounds like some innate resiliency just on its own, internally,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow. Do you play the piano now at all?
Oh, that's a funny question, too, because I've done a couple interviews about the book, and that's a question people often ask. Are you playing the piano now? And as of that shoulder injury a couple of summers ago, I really wasn't. I hadn't touched the piano in 2 years. But I couldn't stand saying to people who interviewed me about the book, sorry, no, I'm not playing the piano. The piano sits totally silent in my home. On the other hand, I'm not willing to lie. So I said to myself, Andrea, if you don't want to have to say no to this question, you need to go back to the piano. So 2 weeks ago, I went back to the piano, and I was like, all right, I'm going to make some kind of music. It's not going to be like I used to, and it's not, I don't even know what it's going to be, but I'm going to try. And I, you know, I eked out a little bit of Chopin and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And it's not, you know, if I measure it against my old self, it's not good. But if I made a little video on my phone, it's 30 seconds long. If I shut my eyes, I think, that's music, and you're still making it. So I did it because I couldn't stand saying to interviewers, no, I don't play the piano anymore. And then it occurred to me, oh, I could probably still write music. So I'm going to do some composing lessons this fall.
Oh, that's great.
Just to kind of try to find my way back to the piano that way.
And it was beautiful. I saw it on Facebook. Oh. It was absolutely beautiful. I'll pull it up for you, Deborah.
Well, I have to friend you after this
yeah,
show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was phenomenal, really. So
you're inspiring me because I grew up playing the piano, but I was forced by my parents. My dad would uh-huh. sit in the living room, and every time I would make a mistake, he would shout out, false. False.
Really?
So I would have to take, you know, I'd have to take my lessons, and my teacher would smack me over the hands if I missed.
Oh my goodness.
It was just bad. So I dreaded it, but I took 7 years worth. I played in adult recitals when I was a child, so I was pretty good. And so I have kept a piano with me everywhere I go. I have to, wherever I live, if it was an apartment or wherever, I had my piano with me and had it be big enough for a baby grand. Mm-hmm. I've kept all of my music, and I haven't played almost at all in 30 years.
God.
So what would you recommend to someone like me who had this sort of negative association to it, but I love music and I love the piano. How do I conquer my own anxiety about just sitting down and knowing that I'm going to be god awful horrible?
Well, one thing you could do, well, the main advice is the same advice I give my students who are like, I want to write. What should I do? Well, sit down and start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, that sounds horrifying to me, to have somebody barking false every time I mess up. That's like the stuff of nightmares.
Right.
But if you played music that couldn't be false and you couldn't be wrong, then, like, what if you're making up your own? What if, I mean, you have enough training in music. What if you're not trying to play music anyone else wrote so it can't be wrong? What if you're just noodling?
I've done that. Yes, I have done that a few times. People have coached me after several glasses of wine, coached me to go, just go sit and play.
Yeah.
And so I
because
have
if
done
it's
that.
Yours, you can't be wrong.
True.
That's a
good
that.
Point.
So I that'd be something.
Just do that every day.
I don't know.
Just make 10 minutes a day to do that.
Can I tell you guys my piano story?
Of course.
It's really funny. So Mrs. Hansen was my piano teacher down the street. So I took piano lessons. I probably was in like first or second grade. And she had a golden retriever named Jake. And Jake would hump me every time I would go. The dog would hump me. And she'd be like, no, Jake, no. So now I associate piano with Jake
no
humping.
Jake.
Yeah, exactly.
Being humped with really
no Jake.
Humping by a golden retriever. But I liked it.
That's
but I wasn't,
really funny.
You know, it wasn't like, I wasn't, you know, I liked it. I was okay. But yeah, it didn't, you know, I'm impressed that when people can really, like, really stick to something, because I was like, yeah, I'm good. I'm good, Mom. Thanks. And that was that.
That's funny.
Mrs. Hansen.
My piano teacher had a handsome son who I, you know, ogled.
Uh-huh.
But he never humped my leg while I was playing. Much to my continued dismay.
So funny.
One of my teachers actually lived in Shirley Temple's original house.
Oh, really?
Yes,
oh, wow.
In the valley. So I got to go into that house where she grew
cool.
up. Isn't that cool?
That is really
yeah.
cool.
That is cool.
She had a collection of something like 12 organs, the teacher.
Oh, my God.
She's
oh.
more of an organist. What do you call him? An organist?
I think so.
Oh, okay. It's so funny. Yeah. Whenever somebody says organ, I had a client, a couple came in last night. She was, no, I think of like a donor organ. Like, and she was saying, I have to sell my dad's organs. And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And then she's like, oh no. She's like, I mean, you know, the piano type organs. It's really funny when people
That's
say
funny.
That. Yeah, that's what
funny.
I think.
Wow. All those stories. Okay, so what else do you want to tell us about maybe rheumatoid? I have trouble saying rheumatoid arthritis that we haven't covered yet because I want to make sure that all that information gets out there.
I don't know. I mean, I think I covered the like educational aspect of it. You know, I sounded a little snarky when I said that I get tired of fielding questions at the grocery store. And I do because I, you know, in the right context, in a setting like this, any questions, cool, let's talk about anything. Or I go visit classes at Arizona State, and I'll take any question. But I think maybe the one thing that's been a frustrating experience for me is if you look different or if your body announces itself as being non-standard, or there's this very public aspect that I maybe would encourage people to think twice before they kind of accost a woman who's just typing at Starbucks or trying to select exactly the right pen at the pen aisle at Target and demand that she explain to you why her body doesn't look the way you expect it to. What happened to your hands? What's wrong with your knees? What's wrong with your hands? Why do you walk like that? I mean, these are questions that I've gotten from adults when I'm kind of minding my own business. And I think that's been a frustrating aspect of this experience, is the feeling that everywhere I go, I have to be prepared to explain to anyone who wants to know why my hands look the way they do. Where I like to be generous and charitable and approachable in the right setting, I also just want to do my life. I want to write or think, and I don't want to have to be the kind of on-demand spokesperson for why my body doesn't measure up to what you want it to look like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, can you give the finger? Like, can you still do that?
I can't. That's exactly right. I can't do that. I've tried to adopt, like, I'm not Italian by ethnicity, but like the hand under the chin thing.
Yeah.
But then I feel like I'm culturally appropriating and I can't do that either. And so I'm half Norwegian and I think, like, what do Norwegians, how do Norwegians give the finger? And then I think, well, Norwegians probably don't, you know?
Right.
I can't even give the finger. That's the great tragedy of rheumatoid arthritis in my life.
I can't believe your dad hasn't rigged up something you can attach to your hand.
Oh, that's so funny.
Like one of those, like a crank. Where
it on and an automatic thing just flips up.
I should ask him to do that. If I asked him to do that, he'd have
totally
a prototype
would.
By dinner time.
Now I'm thinking if I can put a pen between my fingers here, hold that straight up to somebody. Right,
she's really doing it. This is really funny.
But I do have a bit of a question. Then, as you're saying that, I see that as being intrusive versus people who try to be helpful. Like I usually, if I see anybody struggling with anything in terms of opening a door, like a mom with a baby in a carriage, I will just go over and open the door. Is that offensive or is that
not to me?
Kindness?
No, okay. To me it's and it's always the way people phrase questions. Like I'm interested in language, but when people say, I was at Ross Dress for Less once. I love me some Ross Dress for Less. And I very awkwardly had taken my chosen items to the fitting room, and the fitting room attendant said, what'd you do to your hands? Why are you blaming me? I didn't do this to my hands. But anyway, that's the kind of colloquial way that people... I said, I have rheumatoid arthritis. And she, like, recoiled and said, well, I have arthritis too, but it didn't do that to me. What do you want here, lady? Like, what do you want? You know, I'm not putting these things back on the hanger when I come out of here. That's
right.
What I'm going to do. You know.
Exactly.
I don't mind. To me, I also don't want to put people on guard. Like, I don't know how to act around her. But,
yeah,
you know, if somebody's just kind of minding their own business and the meaning behind your intrusive question is that you want them to explain to you for your sake why their body looks that way, then probably don't ask that question.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Good guideline, yeah.
Like, I was writing at Starbucks once, this woman came up to me and she said, excuse me, do you have cerebral palsy? I was like, she's asking me for a pen.
Oh,
like, oh, no, I don't, you know. And I was like, no, do you? And she's like, oh, no, of course not. Like,
oh, my God.
Rude. I can't imagine that.
So that's the kind of thing. Like, I think if people thought for one more second and they were able to think, like, why am I asking this question? Am I asking this question or am I making this gesture for the person or for myself? and when you're holding a door for someone, you're making, I mean, you would do that for anybody if they were carrying a big bag of groceries, you know?
Sure.
You're just making the way easier for a fellow human.
Right.
That to me feels gracious and good. But when it's this sort of demand for information or a demand, like, I need to understand your body right now on my terms, yeah, then that really pisses me off.
Do you ever like make something up like, well, I got bitten by an alligator, like in the Everglades? I don't know. I mean,
I've toyed with that and I've tried that. But then this other voice in me says, you know, Andrea, rheumatoid arthritis is already so misunderstood.
Yeah.
Here's an opportunity.
I was thinking,
you know,
that.
Here's one less person who won't know what it is if you take the time to explain it to them. So
right.
I kind of don't forfeit those opportunities. Although one time I was at Arizona State and I was a TA and I was taking the elevator to like the second or third floor,
uh-huh,
and this kind of busy full professor type, you know, sighed heavily and she said, really, the second floor? And I just turned to her and I said, well, I have rheumatoid arthritis. This is a chronic autoimmune disease that manifests itself in joint swelling, joint pain, tenderness, fatigue, fevers. And I rode with her all the way to like the sixth or seventh floor where she was going, and uh-huh, just gave her this level, super calm lecture the whole way,
uh-huh,
and then didn't get off at her floor, let her get off, and then I went back down to my floor. So I kind of a sort of kill them with kindness, information kind of approach. But even that gets tiresome, you think.
But like, I can imagine this.
I don't want to be a walking PSA.
I can imagine those sort of as a cathartic experience to say something like what Kelly
just said.
It was
kind of
fun. You know, and then follow it up with, no, I'm just kidding.
Right.
Actually, this is a very serious condition. I have rheumatoid arthritis. But
right.
see the expressions on their face.
Yeah.
When you just thump them.
Wow.
I'll have to try it and let you know. I have to think of something really good.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Mm-hmm. How did your family react to you writing this book?
The short answer is incredibly supportively.
Wow.
I didn't tell them about it for a long time. It was something I was just working on my own. But then when it started to look like, you know, this might go somewhere and I might be able to find a publisher for this, I thought it only best to let them read it and weigh in.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, I actually read it out loud to my mom, the whole thing, we were on a road trip.
Hmm.
And so I read it. It was a really helpful experience for me as a writer, too, to, you know, read it out loud. So, and she's just completely supportive. You know, she had a couple of fact corrections for me, and I integrated those, but just completely supportive. Same with my dad. You know, my dad's like, you know, I know I wasn't the best perfect father, and I know I've made mistakes along the way, but I'm so proud of you, and I want you to tell this story, and I don't want any editor to monkey with it and change a single word of it. I like it just the way you wrote it, you know.
Oh, that's beautiful.
My siblings, one of them, my oldest brother, I don't think he said much about it at all, but, you know, I know he's proud of me and excited for me.
Mm-hmm.
My sister isn't completely happy with the way I depicted her, and so we've kind of had a couple maybe kind of uncomfortable conversations where I feel that I was true to my perception of her, but she doesn't like the way I depicted her.
Sure.
And I feel that my depiction of her is resolved as the story progresses. You know, when you write memoir, you have to balance sort of two perspectives. You have to depict things the way you felt them when they were happening,
mm-hmm,
but also through the filter of an older person who understands it now.
Yeah. Sure.
So there are places where I tried to sort of depict her the way I understood or misunderstood her when I was a little kid, and then sort of saved the resolution of how I understand her now for the end to make sort of a satisfying arc in the book as a book. Because a memoir is also not just pure autobiography. It's not, here's the facts that happened in the order in which they happened. It's more like a novel in the sense that you shape storylines and things. So she is not entirely happy with how I depicted her. I think I was true to, I'm not trying to scandalize or embarrass or be unkind to her. I think I was true to our relationship, but, you know. And then my other brother, who I think in the book I actually, you know, if anything, he's the one that did things that people might think are bad, mean things or something. But he loves it. He's so proud of it. And he said something to me the other day that kind of made the book a win no matter what. He said, you know, I'm so proud of you. Your book makes me so proud of you, but your book also makes me proud of me. Like, mm-hmm, if you think I'm that awesome, like, I look awesome in your book. I'm so awesome in your book. if my little sister thinks I'm that awesome, maybe I can borrow some of that, and maybe I can think I'm that awesome. And he kind of needs that right now. And so the idea that, like, the way I depicted him allows him to see himself in a way that he feels proud of.
Sure.
That was like if that's the only thing that came out of my book, I would call that a win.
That is
and
awesome.
I think my sister and I will be okay.
Oh, yay. Andrea, believe it or not, we are out of time. The book is Sonata, A Memoir of Pain and the Piano. Where can they find it and where can they find you?
Well, you can find it anywhere fine books are sold. It's on the shelves at Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. It's also on the shelves of or orderable through your local independent bookseller.
Good.
You know, we want to shop local whenever we can. You can find me on Twitter at AND_Reed. I have a Facebook page, Andrea Avery Author. I would love to hear from readers who read it and tell me things. I'm findable, totally findable.
Well, you are incredible.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for coming
thank
on.
Thank you.
Clap,
thank
clap,
you
clap.
So much.
Yay. So right. Awesome.
And okay. Kelly, say hi to Scott for me.
Oh, my God. I win. All right, bye,
wink, sweet. Wink.
We'll do the down and dirty on that one.
Yeah,
next week.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway,
bye,
thank you so much for joining us. Next week, we have David Eskebius, who's a trust attorney. He's going to talk to us about the do's and don'ts in wills and trusts and family matter complications. Have an awesome week.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.